Tools and Weapons is a podcast exploring the promise and the peril of the digital age, hosted by Microsoft's Vice Chair and President Brad Smith. His latest guest is Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though most of us know Bayer for its pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science, with the goal of making sure no one on planet Earth goes hungry. On Tools and Weapons, Brad and Bill discuss how the German company is using artificial intelligence paired with CRISPR technology to increase food production without fertilizers. Their efforts put AI and digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre on a hotter, more crowded planet. The veteran biotech executive also shares his thoughts on how to keep things innovative at a company that's been around since the 1860s. It's the latest conversation in a series that invites listeners to pull up a front row seat to some of the most important developments in technology today. You can find this episode and many more of Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you get your podcasts.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well.
I absolutely love this because, you know, if you own a home, it can be really hard to maintain. It's hard to find people that can help you for a big project or a small. Well, whether it's in everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality, it can be hard just to know where to start. But now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app. Answer a few questions and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish, or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
At Popular Science, we report and write dozens of science and tech stories every week. And while most of the stuff we stumble across makes it into our articles, we also find plenty of weird facts that we just keep around the office. So we figured, why not share those with you? Welcome to The Weirdest Thing I Learned This Week from the editors of Popular Science. I'm Rachel Feltman.
I'm Sarah Kylie Watson.
I'm Kasia Patel.
Kasia, welcome to the show. It's so great to have you. It's been a while, but I believe we did a panel together once about science and comedy. So I'm very excited to have you bring some science comedy to the show. But why don't you tell listeners a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Okay. Yeah, sure. Yeah. You know, don't have your expectations too high, listeners, about a funny science joke. We'll see how quippy I can be on the fly. Rachel's very quippy, as is Sarah. So hopefully I can keep up to them. What was I supposed to do? Say what about me?
Yeah. Who you are, what you do.
Oh, right. I know that answer. Okay. Yeah, I'm Kasia Patel. I am a science writer and comedian with a specialization in science jokes, which is not really a thing. So
I believe it should be.
I also believe it should be, which is why I decided to make it a thing. There are a few of us that do it around the world. I've probably been doing it for about, I made my first science comedy show like 10 years ago, maybe by now 8 to 10 years ago. And yeah, it's cool. I joke about life as a scientist. I joke about certain scientific studies and just like interesting science facts. A couple of the facts on your show, I've tried writing jokes about or like have wrote related jokes about when I was listening to the episode. So I feel like we're going to vibe pretty well.
Awesome. So on The Weirdest Thing I Learned This Week, we start by each offering up a little tease about some kind of fact or story that we found in the course of reading, writing, reporting, writing jokes, etc., and decide which one we just absolutely have to hear more about first. Then, once we've all had time to spin our little science yarns, we reconvene and decide what the weirdest thing we learned this week actually was, except not in like a ranked competitive way anymore, because I have officially decided that is too hard and annoying and everybody wins on this show. And I have not rewritten the intro yet, and maybe I never will. Does this bother you? Let me know in the comments. There are no comments. Unless you're listening on YouTube, in which case do let me know in the comments. Anyway, Sarah Kylie, what's your tease?
Okay, so my tease is that one of our oldest human relatives could not only walk upright, but they were also super duper buff.
I love that for them.
Yeah.
I can neither walk upright nor am I super duper buff, but I'm working on both every day.
I was going to say, good for them. I'm glad you guys have goals. That's fine.
Kasia, what's your tease?
My tease is that we could be breathing in fungi that could harm us in wildfire smoke. That sounded really depressing. That's such a depressing tease.
Well, I love a fungal fact.
Me too.
Wildfire, a little bit of a bummer. You know, we're recording this in June. It's going to air later in the summer when I assume the air will be even worse. But yeah, after like last week's horrible air quality in the New York area, today it's like moderate. It's like what I would consider a bad air quality day before what happened last week. So I'm like, the air's kind of spicy. I don't like that. I was already like, we were already a 3 air purifier household. So I'm equipped. My fact, very, very different. I want to talk about why male mice are terrified of bananas and how scientists accidentally found out.
Ah, I feel it. I tried writing a joke about this one. I even have like my document and I can pull it up. And I never, I never got a good punchline. So maybe you will help me create a punchline for it.
Oh my gosh. I was super happy to help you workshop this. Well, I can get started with scaredy cat male mice.
Let's do it.
Yeah. Okay. So a while back, researchers at McGill University were studying pain sensitivity in mice, and they noticed something weird, which is that when pregnant female mice, which were being used for a totally different experiment, were kept close by, the male subjects started acting strangely. A grad student apparently picked up on the fact that they were like aggressive and seemed, you know, sort of anecdata, it seems like their pain thresholds were higher when the pregnant females were in the area. And of course, not only is this like a weird quirk, you know, would love to know more, but it was also potentially messing up the study's results because, again, they were studying pain thresholds, pain sensitivity in mice. So this notion that this grad student got that female pregnant mice were making them less susceptible to pain, they were like, what if that's skewing all of our data? And further, you know, what if other previously published studies were inadvertently skewed because people just didn't realize that keeping pregnant mice around did something? So they decided to start a new experiment to investigate further. And I love that because it's just such a like, it's both curiosity driven and like a weird kind of accidental curiosity journey, but also just like this very concrete, like, how science works and like what's often wrong about how we do science. So I find this very satisfying, even as just like a lead in. So then they tried like the usual number of variations of like trying to figure out exactly what it is about female mice plus young male mouse plus pregnancy trauma. So they were like, what's going on? So they'd like introduced the male mice to a mouse who had just had pups but didn't have them with her, like a mouse really early in gestation, a mouse who was still lactating, a guy mouse, etc. And ultimately, they zeroed in on the fact that soiled bedding from a pregnant female was enough to give males the superhuman or super mouse, if you will, pain tolerance. And a look at their hormonal levels also showed that they were experiencing a spike in stress hormones. So that meant it was time to investigate some urine because that's what was soiling the bedding. They eventually isolated the chemical N-pentyl acetate as the signal that the males were reacting to. And totally coincidentally, N-pentyl acetate is what gives bananas their signature odor. And so the researchers were like, great, we have a way to see whether this chemical, you know, in isolation of other mousy things has this effect. So they went to the like local supermarket and picked up some banana oil and like doused cotton balls in it to see if their presence would have some similar effect. And sure enough, the banana funk raised stress hormones and lowered pain sensitivity in these young male mice. And in both cases, both urine and banana, The effect kicked in within 5 minutes and lasted about an hour. The researchers think that this hormonal spike directly relates to like a fight or flight response, basically. You know, the same way that like when we're exposed to something scary or surprising, you know, our cortisol levels go up, we have adrenaline, and it's like whatever you end up doing with that, whether it makes you aggressive or just like panicky, your body is like activated for something, you know, and it's stressful. And so you might be wondering, why would pregnant mice and as a result also bananas have such an effect on young, healthy, virile males, you know? And the answer is that it's because pregnant mice, generally speaking, can and will kick the absolute shit out of a young male mouse. Like, they will just absolutely f*** them up.
I mean, like, you gotta do what you gotta do to survive in this world.
Exactly. Sarah Kylie, you are right on the money. They are just doing what they have to do to survive. Good for her, etc. So yeah, male mice, especially virgins, which, you know, this is not unique to this study, but researchers will refer to virgin animals as being sexually naive, which I always love because it kind of sounds like a diss, have a tendency to try to kill babies. Rodents in general are like more open to infanticide than we would like. Anyone who had a friend with like a traumatic guinea pig litter experience knows this. Females of many species will like chow down on their children if something makes them smell unfamiliar. So again, if you have pet rodents, like, don't handle the newborns. Like, just let her do her thing. You don't want to mess with that. You might make her think that that's food, and then everybody's gonna have a really bad day. Or even if they just like have too many babies at once, because like resource management is important. It's an important part of running a family, you know. Meanwhile, males of many rodent species will go after pups that aren't theirs because basically it's a free snack, and the behavior stays in the gene pool because like the snackers are more likely to like have successful offspring out in the world than guys who mind their own business. And there have been some studies that suggest that introducing the smell of an unfamiliar male is enough to make certain rodent mamas like stop caring for their pups, because and the idea that researchers get at with this, I'm not sure how much of this is like projection, but the idea is that like, they assume some dude is going to come eat them, so they don't want to waste the energy in the meantime. That being said, not all rodents or even like every member of a species that sometimes does this is this way. There's research on the Chilean Daegu, which is this adorable rodent that nests in like big social groups. They're just all friends, and they do not put babies on the menu. And the research on them suggests that there are genes that like make a species more or less likely to go the infanticide route. Some researchers have suggested that communal nesting may have actually evolved as like an alternative to mating with multiple mates, because mating with multiple mates has its own evolutionary costs. You know, males harass females, they might transmit disease, et cetera. But mating with multiple mates is a great strategy for avoiding this male aggression, because you create paternity confusion, which is a great name, I think, for like a band. So paternity confusion, great evolutionary tactic, and communal nesting may have evolved as one way to make that happen. Basically, everybody sleeps in a big old cuddle pile. And so whose babies are whose doesn't matter. They're all just the babies.
I love it.
Which actually reminds me of something that I wrote about in my book, Been There, Done That, A Rousing History of Sex, that I have not talked about on Weirdest Thing before, but was one of my favorite things to research for the book, which is the idea of partible paternity, which is a belief that persists in some groups today that multiple males are required to make a child. The details vary slightly between different groups. Sometimes it's like there's a belief that like literally you need sperm from more than one guy to make a good baby, and sometimes it's more like there's just sort of like some ineffable je ne sais quoi that happens with during sex that is like important and that like it's important for a baby to have some like secondary fathers. But in those groups, it is like very clearly this awesome human evolutionary strategy where just instead of doing that sort of mate and offspring competition, you just decide we're not going to do that. That like everyone is operating under the assumption that like these kids might be part theirs. And so like resources are shared. And, you know, it would be great if we could all share resources without having to have an evolutionary reason for it. But I've always thought it's just such a cool example of like the way things can go differently, you know, culturally and evolutionarily. And there are species where like the whole species has gone that way, where it's just like, listen, who knows? And therefore, let's not eat babies. It's a great takeaway. And by the way, actually, young females without pups, speaking of mice specifically again, are also known to sometimes like go bananas on another mouse's babies. But they stop this behavior once they have kids of their own. Like generally, a mouse mom will not just randomly attack another mouse mom's pups. And researchers have found that there's like a whole region of the brain that quiets down after a mouse gives birth, and that chemically blocking that region can quiet a young lady's bloodlust. While stimulating it can send any mouse on a baby eating rampage. So brains are wild.
I think the part about the communal paternity is quite heartwarming, right? Because especially when you compare it to humans, like you have things like Mari where it's literally just trying to figure out who the father is, like child, like I don't know. I think it'd be very interesting to just live. I mean, I guess they have communities like that where like, you know, everyone is just like for everybody, right? Where it's just like you go in there.
Mama Mia.
Yeah, it's true. Basically, if you don't understand the concept of partible paternity, Mama Mia is a great example. I would rather have one third of a daughter.
Yeah, it's so sweet.
Everyone's had three dads.
So with mice specifically, studies have shown that there's this gene called TRPC2, very catchy, and it's a big factor in determining whether a mouse is like a parent of the year or just like a decent babysitter or an infanticidal maniac.
The three choices.
Yeah. So when you turn off the TRPC2 gene in a female, they will start to act like males. I didn't find a reference to them eating babies. I don't know if that's something they studied. This was like they put them in with other adults, but they ran around trying to mount all the other mice. So definitely some specific behaviors were happening. And then when scientists engineered a male mouse with an activated TRPC2 gene, he reacted to the introduction of strange pups not by attacking them, but by building a nest and gently placing the foundlings inside. He went Mandalorian. And again, that is just like there's a protein that this gene encodes for, and it seems to be crucial in allowing animals to sense pheromones, which of course are chemical signals that enact some kind of response in the animal that senses them. But still, it's so wild to me that like one protein can just like radically alter behavior that way. This brings us back around finally to the banana business. Basically, the researchers concluded that what was happening is that nursing mothers in their pee were giving off this chemical signal that was like, don't mess with my pups or I will f*** you up. And that males have evolved to actually listen to that or at least get ready for the fight of their lives. Like either way, they have this surge of stress hormones. They suddenly become less susceptible to pain. They're ready for a mama to come absolutely wail on them. So obviously this finding is like kind of weird and funny, but it's also important, just like the researchers in this study initially, Many scientists studying animal behavior in the lab may be inadvertently introducing variables that mess up their data. And the researchers actually pointed out something specific about this that, again, gets into like some deeper issues in science, which is that female pheromones in particular have been like very poorly studied. There's been a lot more research on the chemical signals that male animals produce, basically across species, because there is this known bias in lab animals to study males. For a long time, this had to do with like, oh, the hormonal cycles of female animals, including humans, in drug trials, it's too big of a variable. So like, why introduce it? But like, it's all back to this like real strange misapprehension of the male body being the default, that being normal, and then, you know, anything else being a complication. So they're basically like, listen, like, people have not really studied the chemical signals that female mice or most other female animals give off, and we're really missing stuff because of that. And also, who knows, like, maybe a grad student's unfortunate choice of snack could like skew an experimental result. If you're looking at mice and you bring a banana into the room, all bets are off. So I really love this. That's all I have to say about it. But what a delight. That's my take. I think we've talked about bananas on Reason quite a bit. Claire once talked about the first, the introduction of the banana to like U.S. audiences at the World Fair, where it was sold for quite a lot of money. I think it was the equivalent of like $20.
Oh my gosh.
And came wrapped in a foil packet, which is so funny because bananas literally have their own
packet.
But they unwrapped it, wrapped it in foil, and then gave people a fork and a knife.
Oh, interesting. Was it all brown, though? Like, because you're not supposed to wrap bananas.
Yeah, that's a great question. I guess they, like, peeled them right on site and then were like, here it is. I've wrapped it for you, like a hot dog, because that's the only food that Americans know how to consume at the World's Fair.
But eat it with the fork and knife, please.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. All right, we're going to take a quick break, but then we'll be back with some more facts.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well.
I absolutely love this because, you know, if you own a home, it can be really hard to maintain. It's hard to find people that can help you for a big project or a small. Well, whether it's in everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality, it can be hard just to know where to start. But now all you need to do is Angie that. And find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish. Or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps, because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
Tools and Weapons is a podcast exploring the promise and the peril of the digital age, hosted by Microsoft's Vice Chair and President Brad Smith. His latest guest is Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though most of us know Bayer for its pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science, with the goal of making sure no one on planet Earth goes hungry. On Tools and Weapons, Brad and Bill discuss how the German company is using artificial intelligence paired with CRISPR technology to increase food production without fertilizers. Their efforts put AI and digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre on a hotter, more crowded planet. The veteran biotech executive also shares his thoughts on how to keep things innovative at a company that's been around since the 1860s. It's the latest conversation in a series that invites listeners to pull up a front row seat to some of the most important developments in technology today. You can find this episode and many more of Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, we're back. And Sarah Kiley, now that we've talked about mouse infanticide, please tell me about our buff ancient ancestors, please.
We love some ancient ancestors. Well, yeah, so this is a study. So
Fun fact, I'm being Laura this week, which means I've written about a lot of really fun things. our science writer is on vacation. So this is one I actually had to like dig in and write myself for the website this week. So hopefully I know what I'm talking about. But basically, there's like a couple of things that we think about as like making humans human. And one of those is walking upright. So beyond just walking bipedally, like with our feet, there's like something about like actually like standing up, and I'll get into it. But I wanted to start by talking a little bit about, you know, just a couple million years of evolution, of human evolution. So I'm going to run through real quick. Bear with me. And then I will tell you a little bit more about our buff ancestor and why we're even talking about them at all. But yeah, so humans and our lineage split from chimpanzees, which are, yeah, our closest living relative today, about 7 million ago. But like primates were evolving for 55 million years before that. So, well, there's a lot more that I'm not covering in today's class. but we don't really know what the split between chimps and humans like exactly look like. But around 6 million years ago, there was a bit of evidence that one of the earliest human knowns, which is called the Sahelanthropus, was walking around on 2 feet, which is a big deal bipedally. So fast forward a few million years, we're starting to see the Australopithecus. Australopithecus. And I looked this one up earlier because I always mess up saying things. so that genus started showing up. And that evidence was pointing to, again, the ability standing on 2 feet. And this species was starting to look more like a human than like an ape. So they're kind of like human slash ape versus like the earlier ones were like, okay, this is quite ape looking. And then fast forward again, 2 or 3 million years, and we've got tools being made. And this is like also around the middle of when Australopithecus Africanus's reign was like going on. So they had a bigger brain than their predecessors. So we're starting to see brains get big. We love that. By around 1.89 million years ago, the Homo erectus was walking around and was considered, as the Smithsonian says, to possess quote unquote modern human-like body proportions with long legs and short arms, compared to the size of the torso, as well as an expanded brain case, which is a big deal because, I mean, if you have short arms and long legs, it really just doesn't make sense to do anything except walk around bipedally. I mean, I haven't walked around on all fours in a while, but it's not comfortable.
Yeah, we're not well suited to it.
It just doesn't feel quite right. But yep, so those guys lived on Earth about 9 times as long as Homo sapiens have, just which I think is very cool.
Wow.
So
humbling.
Yeah, this is a whole, this is a Homo sapien humbling piece today. And about 800,000 years ago, things start to speed up during, again, the Homo erectus's reign. These cousins of ours were like figuring out how to use like fire. And then a little bit later, brain sizes like exploded and you get a bunch more Homo genus cousins, Neanderthals, Homo naledi, yada, yada, yada. Homo sapiens, aka us, didn't even come on the scene until 300,000 years ago, and we figured out farming 12,000-ish years ago, and here we are now talking on a podcast. So
that's it. That's all that happened. I love it.
Perfect. Yeah, complete history. Summary.
So that's it. That's human history. And all that being said, we've got this long, complicated evolutionary history behind us. It's kind of confusing to think about like what it means to be human. Like, how different are we from these other like humans that were wandering around like a couple hundred thousand years ago, or even like millions of years ago, and you know what really is different. So now I'm going to dive into the newer part of the factoid, which actually starts still in the past. So I'm sure we've talked about Lucy on here before. Lucy is the OG, one of the OG like original old humans that was found in November of 1974. There were a couple of paleontologists like scooting around and looking at things in Ethiopia. They'd taken a Land Rover, according to Arizona State University, and they were like going to map out somewhere. And after a long, hot morning of mapping and surveying for fossils, they headed back to the vehicle. And one of them was like, let's go do a little something different, go through a different gully. And within seconds or moments, he had spotted like a forearm bone and was like, oh, wow. Shoot, this is a hominid. And so he saw the skull bone, a femur, some ribs, pelvis, lower jaw. Two weeks later, after many hours of excavation, screening, and sorting, several hundred fragments of bone had been recovered, representing 40% of a single hominid skeleton. Lucy, who is an Australopithecus a Phoronesis, because it's about a place in Ethiopia. Very exciting. And so, yep, we've got this like awesome skeleton. Basically, a skeleton is 40% of a single hominid, which is still a pretty big deal considering it's 1970s. We're not really sure what was going on. But we have been able to figure out a ton with less than half of a skeleton. For example, her discovery like further proved the rise of, you know, bipedality, which even as far back as like 3 million ago when Lucy's species was running around, and that was officially established in the mid 70s as well. So we're basically with this discovery, we're like, okay, so people were walking around on 2 feet 3 million years ago. And at the time, she was the oldest hominin species known, but yeah, we found some other things in the past 40 years. But back to this week's discovery. So we know that for a really long time, human ancestors have been walking around on 2 feet. But the difference between just walking around on 2 feet and walking upright is kind of where we have drawn the line of like humanness. Because, I mean, ostriches and kangaroos and certain rodents and all sorts of things, birds, tons of dinosaurs, tons of things walk around on 2 feet, but they're not all human. So what is like the difference between like bipedalism and like and walking upright? And when did that this distinction get made? So nobody really knows when this happened and when like human bipedalism versus like a primate-y version of bipedalism happened. And there's been a lot of debate in the past, you know, 40 years that we've had Lucy. And some experts think she probably waddled around more like a chimpanzee, whereas others think she walked upright like modern humans. And so one of the ways that we find out how animals that are no longer with us on this planet were moving around in their days by recreating soft tissues and muscles, since they don't really make it in terms of like the fossil record. Obviously, hard stuff makes it way longer than the soft stuff. And that comes in pretty much every single case that you can think of, like even, yeah. Like, obviously, we have had some lucky chances of getting a couple pieces of soft tissue and muscle, but it is rare, especially when it's from 3 million years ago. But yeah, so there is a way that scientists have found a way to, like, 3D model muscles. And we've done this before. The, like, one noted example of this is how we learned that T-Rexes couldn't run very fast. So basically, like, I mean, you think about T-Rexes and you're just terrified and you're like, oh my gosh, and you see a skeleton, you're like, oh goodness, like that thing would definitely eat me up.
But I think, goodness indeed.
Yeah. Oh goodness indeed. But by recreating muscles, we can actually see like how that skeleton actually moved throughout space. Like, and so yeah, T-Rexes don't run very fast, which is, you know, I don't know if that's been on Weir's thing before, but whoever's listening, that's your next one if you want
it. They're trash. No. But
every time I hear T-Rex, I always think of that cartoon movie scene where the T-Rex is like, I have a big head but small arms. So, yeah. I don't think we thought this out all the way.
We love evolution. Why is she so weird? Why does she do this over and over again? I don't know. But yeah, we hadn't done the T-Rex method on a hominid. So a bunch of Cambridge researchers led by Ashley Wiseman, they were like, okay, let's put some muscles on Miss Lucy. Let's see what's going on. And so they recreated 36 of Lucy's muscles, specifically in her legs. And basically, by doing this, they were able to recreate her movements. And so what Wiseman said was, Lucy's ability to walk upright can only be known by reconstructing the path and space that a muscle occupies within the body. We are now the only animal that can stand upright with straight knees. Lucy's muscles suggest that she was as proficient at bipedalism as we are, while possibly being at home in the trees. Lucy likely walked and moved in a way that we do not see in any living species today. And so,
wow, Lucy, look at you go.
I know, Lucy girl, she's 3 feet tall, she's got a tiny brain, she weighs 60 pounds, and she also could swing through the trees, and she could also walk around the savannah like a modern human. So this is a big deal because we aren't so sure, like, where bipedalism came along in, like, terms of, like, brain size, in terms of, like, species, in terms of genus. You know, this is before Homo was happening. So it's a pretty big deal. And the other fun part is that Lucy was super-duper muscular, and her calves and thighs were over twice the size of those in modern humans. So she's little, wow. But she is strong. She is tough.
Jealous.
Like, she definitely win, like, whatever Iron Man. Not, what's it called? Not Iron Man. The one where you, like, bench press a bunch of stuff. I don't know sports.
Oh, like strongman competition?
Yeah, yeah. Something.
Also, like, American Ninja Warrior.
Oh, yeah.
I want to see her go for the gold. I feel like I've mentioned this on Weirdest Thing before, but, like, there are two times in my life I can remember researchers, like, being so mad at each other professionally that they, like, almost basically called me stupid on the phone for, like,
what?
Taking their nemesis's work into account. And one of them was somebody talking about a Lucy study.
Oh,
about
my
whether
gosh.
She climbed trees a lot. It was something, it was like very, and they were like, you can't tell that from Bode. And they were like, you can't not tell that from Bode. And it was just, I was like, you guys need to hug it out. Like, you literally, you study the same old broad. Like, you should be friends.
We're all obsessed with Lucy here. It's okay. Like, we can all share her. Oh my gosh. Well, yeah. So apparently she was walking as well as swinging. So that's great. And oh, a fun fact, muscles made up 74% of the total mass in Lucy's thighs versus like 50% of muscle in humans. So it's like she was going crazy.
That's what my legs were like when I was still doing roller derby. Everything you're saying is just making me picture my friends who still play roller derby. That's what they're built like. They're built different.
Everything you're saying is making me realize, like, how much I'm not like Lucy, especially compared to the average person. Like, I think my muscles in my legs are, like, probably 15% of my leg. I'm not muscular at all. Like, I aspire to be like Lucy. I'm going to go climb a tree after this. Like, this is very motivating.
Yeah.
Exactly. But, yeah, I mean, I think this one's fun just because, I mean, Homo sapiens really do consider ourselves to be so special and different. But some of our most, like, human-like qualities or whatever aren't really exclusively attributed to us. Obviously, Lucy came like a long time before Neanderthals, but a couple of things that we've written about just the past couple of months, like Neanderthals, they cooked crabs, they had family bonds, a whole different species of Homo was recently credited with burying their own dead like 100,000 years before Homo sapiens even began to do that, even though their brains were considered tiny. Yeah, go Lucy, go other ancient humans. Show us that we're just not that special and that it's a little bit more complicated than that, even though we're the last one standing. So
I'd argue our brains got too big. There was a time when we had funerals and clam bakes and mind our own business and didn't have existential nausea, I imagine.
True. No, I stumbled upon like one story where basically a couple of scientists like attributed the dominance of Homo sapiens to the being the only species to quote unquote have colonized the entire globe and all of its environments. So we're just like good at taking stuff over. That's it. Like apparently, according
cool.
to these scientists.
Yeah.
So
I'm just gonna aspire to be like thick thighs, just vibes.
Yeah.
Like
I
Lucy.
Like that. Thick thighs, just vibes. That could yep. be the name of your album. I like it.
Yeah.
Your next book, Thick Thighs, Just Vibes.
Oh my gosh.
Vibes.
Yeah, absolutely.
By Parental Confusion or
my
whatever
memoirs.
It was.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break and then we'll be back with one more fact. Okay, we're back. And tell us some fun guy facts.
Yeah. Well, I'm very lucky because I didn't realize that you are somewhat of a fungi expert as well, because you said you studied it in college. Isn't that right?
I did. I did some mycology in undergrad and I really loved it. I'm very like out of the loop on like super recent mycology research. But I always say if I had gotten a PhD in something, it would have been that. So I love talking about the mushrooms.
Ooh,
mushrooms.
The way that I feel about it, when you were learning these fungi facts, were you just like freaking out at everything you learned? Because that's what I feel like my life has been for the past few months. Every time I learn a new fungi fact, I'm like, how did I not know this?
It definitely is. Like, I took mycology just as like I went to a very small liberal arts school and I was doing environmental science. So it's like there were only so many sort of like 200 level science courses without a prerequisite, and I took mycology, And then, like, every day it blew my dang mind.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're wild. And it's like, why don't people talk about this more? They're like way more interesting than most things I learned about in like high school bio.
Yes, I would agree with that. Sarah, do you know what's your fungi knowledge like?
Limited, I would say. But I mean, I definitely have found some fungi in my shower before. But that's about some home experiments. Unfortunately, that's probably it.
Perfect. Yeah. So basically, I came across this because we've been having some pretty, I mean, there are record wildfires up in Canada. And you guys might remember that the smoke has come over to the East Coast. It's like created record air pollution days. It's some of the worst, you know, for some cities on record or in decades. And I was tasked to write a story saying what exactly is in our wildfire smoke. And I think we all kind of know the most harmful component for humans is particulate matter, specifically something called PM 2.5. 2.5 talks about how small it is, 2.5 microns. It's smaller than like the strand of the thickness of a strand of hair. So basically just means you can go inside your body and go inside your lungs and it causes a lot of respiratory issues. And, you know, that can actually send people to the hospital and cause death. There are other things that are involved in that, though. They're like, there are things called HAPs, hazardous air pollutants, which is pretty obvious. I don't know why you had to make an acronym for that. But those are things like formaldehyde and benzene. It's these kind of other things that happen because maybe the tree that you're burning or whatever material you're burning didn't fully combust. So if it fully combusts, that means you're going to get kind of like a clean product, which is like carbon dioxide and water vapor. Here, if it doesn't fully combust, you're going to get all these other toxic things. So those are interesting because those are actually being created from the process of burning. I also learned, a researcher told me, that sometimes wildfire smoke can also spread stuff in the soil, like bacteria, fungi, and he even mentioned arsenic, which I was like, wait a second, what? And it's been in recent years, it's been something that has been appearing more with hospitalizations, and there's been more research into it. And now I'm not trying to fearmonger, say, like, you know, when you see wildfire smoke, like, you might catch like a fungus infection because, you know, there's so many other things in there that are more worrying. And we also don't necessarily know how far it can spread. But this little nugget just kind of piled on to all the crazy things that I've been learning about fungi in the past few months, all thanks to HBO's The Last of Us. Did you guys watch that show?
Oh, yeah.
I did. And in that like opening scene where they're like talking to academics and he's like, the next outbreak is going to be fungal. And I'm like, this is a real conversation people have. So many people are going to Google this now and learn so much about fungus, but also be so scared.
Yeah.
And you're describing me. And that is 100% correct. So, everyone was talking about like, oh, could this actually happen? And I had to write an article about how likely is a fungus pandemic because like you'd see in Last of Us. And in that search, I found a lot of very interesting things. Like for one thing, in that opening scene, they talk about the climate adaptability for fungus. And they're like, well, you know, for the most part, fungus can only affect people who are already like immunocompromised or sick, or the probability that they'll infect a perfectly healthy individual is very difficult for two main reasons. One, the person's immune system will be able to fight it off. And two, they can't withstand really high temperatures like it would be in our body. And I talked to one researcher that I thought this was interesting. He actually has this theory that maybe one of the reasons the dinosaurs met their fate was because of a fungus pandemic or epidemic there locally. And he's saying that the cool conditions that happened allowed the proliferation of all this fungus, and then it could actually infect the cold-blooded reptiles, and that's what killed them. Right. So, you know, it's a theory. We have a lot of theories about how the dinosaurs died. But basically, it's actually not that far-fetched to think that this fungus can adapt to higher temperatures, and we actually have cases like that now. There's a particular fungus called Candida auris, which is creating a lot. It's creating a lot of issues in hospitals now. During pandemic, it also caused a lot of issues with people who were hospitalized with COVID because they had compromised immune systems. But there's actually, so Candida auris, the researcher told me, and they have published studies on this, that it kind of came out of, I don't want to say nowhere, but for the sake of this conversation, nowhere. It just like simultaneously emerged on different continents all at once. And they found that it actually was, it had a higher heat tolerance than other fungus. And there's been other studies that have come out during the show and since I wrote that my last article, showing lab experiments that fungus can adapt over generations to higher fungus. And as they said in the show, you know, you can't really treat it that well. Some of them are resistant to antibiotics, and some of them are really difficult to even come up with a good treatment for it because, and this is a fact I did not know, apparently the DNA compatibility between fungus and humans are very closely tied, like fungi are more closely linked to humans than they are to plants.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. And they're, they produce chitin, like beetles. Like they're very, they're very much like, you know, we lump them in with plants because they like grow and we can eat some of them. But right. they're very much not. They are a different thing.
Yeah. So basically, the reason that it's difficult to create a treatment for them is because if you create a medicine that can attack a fungal infection in humans, it might also attack the human. So it can be toxic to them as well. So it's just kind of like the medicine can't differentiate between this came from a fungus, this is like innate to the human. So it just kind of kills everything, like, you know, like radiation and cancer would. So that's been a big issue. And like Rachel said before, like a lot of researchers have known this is a problem, but there's just not enough resources or funding to look into this. So that's kind of like the scary part of fungus that I was not aware of. And the other part is, particularly in, let's say, wildfire smoke. Now, when you think about like, okay, how on earth would wildfire smoke move like mushrooms? Obviously it's not moving like mushrooms, but there are certain fungi that are found in the soil, and one of those is valley fever, which I think is becoming increasingly popular in the news. It's on the west coast, like Arizona, parts of California, and this is actually found in soils. So it's not surprising that you know, wildfire smoke can kind of kick up the soil. But it's what's in that soil. And valley fever has been spread within dust storms. Like in Arizona, people kind of know that, oh, there's a dust storm. If I'm downwind, they will feel the effects of valley fever. And what that does, it just creates a lot of like respiratory issues, coughing. I mean, it can be treated, I think. You should fact check that. But it just causes a lot of like coughing and respiratory issues. But now with wildfire smoke, and what lab studies have shown is that it's actually valley fever is the one that can actually spread, get kicked up by the smoke and spread. Now, people don't actually know how far something like this could go. But like, you know, wildfire smoke, as we already evidenced recently, it goes from Canada to the East Coast. So, I mean, it can go.
It was in North Carolina when I was home. North Carolina. Oh, yeah. I'm not a fan.
Like during wildfire season, wildfires from Russia can like come over to across the Atlantic and come to the U.S. So, I mean, it can go really far. But now under what concentrations that is going to be, you know, variable. But in terms of exactly how that can be packaged, you know, researchers say they don't actually quite know. But one idea is that they know there's certain evidence that shows that this fungi and some of the bacteria can withstand the high heat in certain aspects. But even if they, and in some cases, they might not even need to, it could actually be protected in small clusters of particulate matter.
Girl.
So it might not even be exposed to the fire. So it just might not be a point for them. The studies that I have seen, like I said, there's a couple of studies, one in Lancet that was actually published of March this year. They actually looked at this valley fever and they found that months after there was wildfire smoke, they saw hospital admissions for this increase. Increased by about 20% in hospitals in the month following any smoke exposure, which to me is pretty crazy because it's just so long lasting.
Yeah.
The other thing about valley fever, you know, even without wildfire smoke transporting it places, it's kind of a tricky one because there are other studies that show, like climate models, that with climate change, its coverage, which is primarily kind of like Arizona, California, like the western area, could double. I think it's by the end of the century.
Yeah, I remember my mycology professor, one of the things he really emphasized to us was like, doctors would call him asking about fungal infections. Like, I'm sure this has improved somewhat in the last decade and change, but like, it was just not common for medical schools to talk about fungal infections beyond like yeast infections, thrush. So he was like, listen, if you, based on the knowledge you learn in this class, suspect that what's going on with you is fungal, like, bring some research with you to the hospital because they will not know what to do.
Oh, that's so frightening.
I mean, we saw that in The Last of Us, that they didn't go to a doctor to ask what was going on. They went to a researcher. And also, we can see how rare a diagnosis of a fungus is because I've been watching a lot of House recently over a pandemic.
Amazing.
And they always talk about it. Even Scrubs, I've been watching, I guess, a lot of fictional medical shows. But even Scrubs, I remember like the crazy thing that ended up being it was like a fungus. And yeah, it's just, I guess I should say that, you know, not all fungus is bad. We have so much fungus living in us and on us that do a lot of really good things for us. And to end on a positive note, if you are wondering if a fungal pandemic like The Last of Us is probable, the answer is not in that same rendition.
Yeah, no. You'll get fungal pneumonia. Don't worry. It'll be less weird.
You will not have a fungus overtaking your body and trying to control your movements, even though some can do that in ants.
Yeah.
Researchers told me that fungus is not adapted or has not evolved in the human body to do that. So, you know, just be safe and just, you know, avoid all wildfire smoke, I think, whether there's fungus in it or not.
Yeah, that's a good takeaway in general.
And if
there were a lot of people out there like raw dog in the air in New York. And
oh my
I was
God.
Like,
oh my God.
Just put a mask on.
I could not believe it because you can see it so visibly. Like the cloud, like there was a darkness in the sky at noon.
Horrific.
But people are like, we can't let the wildfire smoke win. Yeah, we can. For one day, we can. We can stay inside.
Yeah, I've been seeing a lot of articles that were like, the East Coast just had its climate moment. And I was like, we'll see if it sticks.
Yeah, okay. We'll see.
You are not, you are underestimating the willpower of humans to ignore things, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I loved all of the weird things we learned this week. Like I said, I no longer pick a winner. I don't believe in winners and losers anymore.
You're like the communal paternity. Like,
it's
there's
true.
No
yeah. It's true. Winners. We all I just share. Want everybody to have a good time.
I just want a yeah. third of a win. That's it.
True. It's more of a win than I ever thought I'd have. Kasia, thanks so much for coming on. Remind our listeners where they can find you for science comedy and science not comedy.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This was fun. You can find my science comedy. I mean, I'm based in Washington, D.C., but I'll be doing tours along the East Coast and West Coast this fall. So you can find that out on my Instagram, Kasia Blanca, or my website, Kasia Patel. And then for my science writings, which, you know, I think I will be doing a more in-depth article about wildfire smoke and fungi, I write a column for the Washington Post called Hidden Planet. So, yeah, you can check me out on any of the things, and you can Google me. I'm pretty Googleable.
Awesome. The Weirdest Thing I Learned This Week is produced by all of our hosts, including me, Rachel Faltman, along with Jess Bodie, who also serves as our audio engineer and editor extraordinaire. Our theme music is by Billy Cadden. Our logo is by Katie Beloff. If you have questions, suggestions, or weird stories to share, tweet us at weirdest_thing. Thanks for listening, weirdos.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well.
I absolutely love this because, you know, if you own a home, it can be really hard to maintain. It's hard to find people that can help you for a big project or a small. Well, whether it's in everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality, it can be hard just to know where to start. But now all you need to do is Angie that. And find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish. Or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps, because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.